This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Day After Roswell by Colonel Philip Corso, retired, with William J. Burns. Read by William J. Burns.
Forward by Senator Strom Thurmond. When I was first elected to the United States Senate in 1954, the United States and democratic Western governments were locked in a bitter and sometimes deadly Cold War with totalitarian communist governments that sought to expand their bankrupt ideology throughout the world. Though those who did not live during this era have a hard time picturing it, the 1950s and 1960s were a period in our history when there was a very real need to be concerned about a communist, especially Soviet, threat to our security and institutions. As a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, I took a lead role in seeking out those in our government who sought to muzzle military personnel, who wanted to alert Americans to the threats we faced from our communist enemies, and to speak out against some of the plainly misguided, incorrect, and frankly, dangerous policies of the United States in dealing with the Soviets and the Red Chinese. Distinguished officers and patriotic men such as Admiral Arleigh Burke and General Arthur Trudeau were essentially censored by their own government because of the views they espoused about the state of the world and the nature of the threat before our nation. As a veteran of World War II, a commissioned officer in the United States Army Reserve, and a proponent of a strong and comprehensive military, I could not sit idly by and watch our military be undermined by people in government who were sympathetic to communism. During this period, the Armed Services Committee held extensive hearings into this matter. It seemed an alien concept that in a nation that protects and cherishes free expression, the men who risked their lives to keep us free and best understood how we should confront our enemies would be ordered silent. It was under these circumstances that I came to know Philip Corso, then a colonel in the United States Army, who was equally disturbed about the muzzling of our military and who shared my concern about the future of our military forces. As the members of the Armed Services Committee worked diligently to discover who was working to quiet our soldiers, sailors, Marines, and airmen, Colonel Corso was brought to my attention by two of my former staff members. The colonel had a great deal of credibility and expertise, not only as a military officer, but also in the fields of intelligence and national security. A veteran of World War II and Korea, Corso also spent 4 years working at the National Security Council. In short, he was very familiar with the issues that concerned me and my colleagues on the Senate Armed Services Committee, and he very quickly became a valued source of bountiful information and was insightful and, most importantly, accurate. As a matter of fact, the material he provided was invaluable in helping us prove the stifling of the American military officers was being ordered by individuals in high-ranking positions within our own government. In 1963, when I learned of Colonel Corso's impending retirement from the Army, I thought that having a man with his background and experiences on my staff would be of great benefit, So after offering him a position that promised nothing more than long hours of hard work at a modest salary, Philip Corso once again willingly went to work serving and protecting the United States, this time as an aide in my office. There is no question that Philip Corso has led a full and adventurous life, and I am certain that he has many interesting stories to share with individuals interested in military history, espionage, and the workings of our government. We should all be grateful that there are men and women like Colonel Corso, people who are willing to dedicate their lives to serving the nation and protecting the ideals we all hold dear, and we should honor the sacrifices they have made in their careers and in their lives. Introduction. My name is Philip J. Corso, and for two incredible years back in the 1960s, while I was a lieutenant colonel in the Army heading up the Foreign Technology Desk in Army Research and Development at the Pentagon, I led a double life. In my routine everyday job as a researcher and evaluator of weapon systems for the Army, I investigated things like the helicopter armament the French military had developed, the tactical deployment complexities of a theater anti-missile missile, or new technologies to preserve and prepare meals for our troops in the field. I read technology reports and met with engineers at Army Proving Grounds about different kinds of ordnance and how ongoing budgeted development projects were moving forward. I submitted their reports to my boss, Lieutenant General Arthur Trudeau, the director of Army R&D and the manager of a 3,000-plus man operation with lots of projects at different stages. On the surface, especially to congressmen exercising oversight as to how the taxpayers' money was being spent, all of it was routine stuff. Part of my job responsibility in Army R&D, however, was as an intelligence officer and advisor to General Trudeau, who himself had headed up Army intelligence before coming to R&D. This was a job I was trained for and held during World War II and Korea. At the Pentagon, I was working in some of the most secret areas of military intelligence, reviewing heavily classified information on behalf of General Trudeau. I had been on General MacArthur's staff in Korea and knew that as late as 1961, even as late maybe as today, as Americans back then were sitting down to watch Dr. Kildare or Gunsmoke, captured American soldiers from World War II and Korea were still living in gulag conditions in prison camps in the Soviet Union and Korea. Some of them were undergoing what amounted to sheer psychological torture. They were the men who never returned. As an intelligence officer, I also knew the terrible secret that some of our government's most revered institutions had been penetrated by the KGB, and that key aspects of American foreign policy were being dictated from inside the Kremlin. I testified to this first at a Senate subcommittee hearing chaired by Senator Everett Dirksen of Illinois in April 1962, and a month later delivered the same information to Attorney General Robert Kennedy. He promised me that he would deliver it to his brother, the president, and I have every reason to believe he did. It was ironic that in 1964, after I retired from the Army and had served on Senator Strom Thurmond's staff, I worked for Warren Commission member Senator Richard Russell as an investigator. But hidden beneath everything I did, at the center of a double life I led that no one knew about, and buried deep inside my job at the Pentagon, was a single file cabinet that I had inherited because of my intelligence background. That file held the Army's deepest and most closely guarded secret, the Roswell files, the cache of debris and information an Army retrieval team from the 509th Army Airfield pulled out of the wreckage of a flying disc that had crashed outside the town of Roswell in the New Mexico desert in the early morning darkness during the first week of July, 1947. The Roswell file was the legacy of what happened in the hours and days after the crash when the official government cover-up was put into place. As the military tried to figure out what it was that had crashed, where it had come from, and what its inhabitants' intentions were, a covert group was assembled under the leadership of the Director of Intelligence, Admiral Roscoe Hillencutter, to investigate the nature of the flying discs and collect all information about encounters with these phenomena while at the same time publicly and officially discounting the existence of all flying saucers. This operation has been going on in one form or another for 50 years amidst complete secrecy. I wasn't in Roswell in 1947, nor had I heard any details about the crash at that time, because it was kept so tightly under wraps, even within the military. You can easily understand why, though, if you remember, as I do, the Mercury Theater War of the Worlds radio broadcast in 1938, when the entire country panicked at the story of how invaders from Mars landed in Grover's Mill, New Jersey, and began attacking the local populace. The fictionalized eyewitness reports of violence and the inability of our military forces to stop the creatures were graphic. They killed everyone who crossed their path. Narrator Orson Welles said into his microphone as these creatures in their war machine started their march toward New York. The level of terror that Halloween night of the broadcast was so intense, and the military so incapable of protecting the local residents, that the police were overwhelmed by the phone calls. It was as if the whole country had gone crazy, and authority itself had started to unravel. Now, in Roswell, in 1947, the landing of a flying saucer was no fantasy. It was real. The military wasn't able to prevent it. And this time, the authorities didn't want a repeat of War of the Worlds. So, you can see the mentality at work behind the desperate need to keep the story quiet. And this is not to mention the military fears at first that the craft might have been an experimental Soviet weapon because it bore resemblance to some German-designed aircraft that had made their appearances near the end of the war, especially the crescent-shaped Horton flying wing. What if the Soviets had developed their own version of this craft? The stories about the Roswell crash vary from one another in the details. Because I wasn't there, I've had to rely on reports of others, even within the military itself. Through the years, I've heard versions of the Roswell story in which campers, an archaeological team, or rancher Mac Brazzo found the wreckage. I've read military reports about different crashes in different locations in some proximity to the Army airfield at Roswell, like San Augustine and Corona, and even different sites close to the town itself. All of these reports were classified, and I did not copy them or retain them for my own records after I left the Army. Sometimes the dates of the crash vary from report to report, July 2nd or 3rd, as opposed to July 4th. And I've heard different people argue the dates back and forth, establishing timelines that vary from one another in the details. But all agree that something crashed in the desert outside of Roswell and near enough to the Army's most sensitive installations in Alamogordo and White Sands that it caused the Army to react quickly and with concern as soon as it found out. In 1961, regardless of the differences in the Roswell story from the many different sources who had described it, the top secret file of Roswell information came into my possession when I took over the foreign technology desk at R&D. My boss, General Trudeau, asked me to use the Army's ongoing weapons development and research program as a way to filter the Roswell technology into the mainstream of industrial development through the military defense contracting program. Today, items such as lasers, integrated circuitry, fiber optics networks, accelerated particle beam devices, and even the Kevlar material in bulletproof vests are all commonplace. Yet the seeds for the development of all of them were found in the crash of an alien craft at Roswell and turned up in my files 14 years later. But that's not even the whole story. In those confusing hours after the discovery of the crashed Roswell alien craft, the Army determined that in the absence of any other information, it had to be an extraterrestrial. Worse, the fact that this craft and other flying saucers had been surveilling our defensive installations and even seemed to evidence a technology we'd seen evidenced by the Nazis caused the military to assume these flying saucers had hostile intentions and might have even interfered in human events during the war. We didn't know what the inhabitants of these craft wanted, but we had to assume from their behavior, especially their interventions in the lives of human beings and the reported cattle mutilations, that they could be potential enemies. That meant we were facing a far superior power with weapons capable of obliterating us. At the same time, we were locked in a cold war with the Soviets and the mainland Chinese, and were faced with the penetration of our own intelligence agencies by the KGB. The military found itself fighting a two-front war, a war against the communists who were seeking to undermine our institutions while threatening our allies, and, as unbelievable as it sounds, a war against extraterrestrials who posed an even greater threat than the communist forces. So we used the extraterrestrials' own technology against them, feeding it out to our defense contractors and then adapting it for use in space-related defense systems. It took us until the 1980s, but in the end, we were able to deploy enough of the Strategic Defense Initiative, Star Wars, to achieve the capability of knocking down enemy satellites, killing the electronic guidance systems of incoming enemy warheads, and disabling enemy spacecraft, if we had to pose a threat. It was alien technology that we used, lasers, accelerated particle beam weapons, and aircraft equipped with stealth features. And in the end, we not only outlasted the Soviets and ended the Cold War, but we forced a stalemate with the extraterrestrials who were not so invulnerable after all. What happened after Roswell? How we turned the extraterrestrials' technology against them, and how we actually won the Cold War is an incredible story. During the thick of it, I didn't even realize how incredible it was. I just did my job, going to work at the Pentagon day in and day out until we put enough of this alien technology into development that it began to move forward under its own weight through industry and back into the Army. The full import of what we did at Army R&D and what General Trudeau did to grow R&D from a disorganized unit under the shadow of the Advanced Research Project Agency when he first took command to the Army Department that helped create the military guided missile, the anti-missile missile, and the guided missile-launched accelerated particle beam firing satellite killer didn't really hit me until years later when I understood just how we were able to make history. I always thought of myself as just a little man from a little American town in western Pennsylvania, and I didn't assess the weight of our accomplishments at Army R&D, especially how we harvested the technology coming out of the Roswell crash until 35 years after I left the Army when I sat down to write my memoirs for an entirely different book. That was when I reviewed my old journals, remembered some of the memos that I'd written to General Trudeau, and understood that the story of what happened in the days after the Roswell crash was perhaps the most significant story of the past 50 years. So, believe it or not, this is the story of what happened in the days after Roswell, and how a small group of military intelligence officers changed the course of human history. Chapter 1. The Roswell Desert. The night hugs the ground and swallows you as you drive out of Albuquerque and into the desert. As you head east along 40 and then south along 285 to Roswell, there's only you and the tiny universe ahead of you defined by your headlights. On either side, beyond the circle of light, there is only scrub and sand. The rest is all darkness that closes in behind you, flooding where you've been under a giant ocean of black and pushes you forward along the few hundred feet of road directly ahead. The sky is different out there, different from any sky you've ever seen before. The black is so clear it looks like the stars shining through it are tiny windows from the beginning of time, millions of them going on forever. On a hot summer night, you can sometimes see flashes of heat lightning explode in the distance. Somewhere it is light for an instant, then the darkness returns. But the summer is the rainy season in the New Mexico desert, and thunderstorms assemble over you out of nowhere, pound the earth with rain and lightning, pummel the darkness with crashes of thunder, shake the ground until you feel the earth is breaking apart, and then disappear. The ranchers out there will tell you that the local storms can go on all night, bouncing off the arroyos like pinballs in play until they expend themselves over the horizon. That's what it was like 50 years ago on a night much like this. Although I wasn't there that night, I've heard many different versions. Many of them go like this. Base radar at the Army's 509th Airfield outside of the town of Roswell had been tracking strange blips all night on July 1, 1947. So had radar at nearby White Sands, the Army's guided missile base where test launches of German V-2 rockets had been taking place since the end of the war, and at the nuclear testing facility at Alamogordo. The blips would appear at one corner of the screen and then dart across at seemingly impossible speeds for aircraft, only to disappear off another corner. Then they'd start up again. No earthly craft could have maneuvered at such speeds and changed direction so sharply. It was a signature no one could identify, whether it was the same aircraft, more than one, or simply an anomaly from the violent lightning and thunderstorms was anybody's guess. So after operators verified the calibrations of the radar equipment, they broke down the units to run diagnostic checks on the circuitry of the screen imaging devices to make sure their radar panels were operating properly. Once they'd satisfied themselves that they couldn't report any equipment malfunction, the controllers were forced to assume that the screen images were displays of something that was truly out there. They confirmed the sightings with radar controllers at White Sands, but found they could do little else but track the blips as they darted across the screen with every sweep of the silent beacon. The blips swarmed from position to position at will, operating under complete freedom across the entire sky over the Army's most secret nuclear and missile testing sites. Throughout the night and the following day, Army intelligence stayed on high alert because something strange was going on out there. Surveillance flights over the desert reported no sightings of strange objects, either in the sky or on the ground. But any sighting of unidentified aircraft on radar was sufficient evidence for base commanders to assume a hostile intent on the part of something. And that was why the Army intelligence in Washington ordered additional counterintelligence personnel to New Mexico, especially to the 509th, where the activities seemed to be centered. The radar anomalies continued into the next night as Dan Wilmot, owner of a hardware store in Roswell, set up chairs on his front porch after dinner to watch the streaks of lightning flash across the sky in the distance. Shortly before 10 that evening, the lightning grew more intense, and the ground shook under the explosions of thunder from a summer storm that pounded the chaparral off in the northwest of the city. Dan and his wife watched the spectacle from beneath the dry safety of their porch roof. It was as if each new bolt of lightning were a spear that rent the heavens themselves. Better than any 4th of July fireworks, the Wilmots must have been remarking as they watched in awe as a bright oval object streaked over their house and headed off into the northwest, sinking below the rise just before the horizon where it was engulfed in darkness. The sky again became pitch black. By the time the next bolt of lightning shot off, the object was gone. A most unusual sight, Dan Wilmot thought, but it was gone from his sight and gone from his thoughts, at least until the end of the week. Whatever it was that passed over the Wilmot house in Roswell also flew over Steve Robinson as he drove his milk truck along its route north of the city. Robinson tracked the object as it shot across the sky at speeds faster than any airplane he'd ever seen. It was a bright object, he noted, elliptical and solid, rather than a sequence of lights like the military aircraft that flew in and out of the 509th airfield on the city's outskirts. It disappeared behind a rise off in the west toward Albuquerque, and Steve put it out of his mind as he pushed forward on his route. To the civilians in Roswell, nothing was amiss. Summer thunderstorms were common. The reports of flying saucers in the newspapers and over the radio were simply circus sideshow amusements. And an object streaking across the sky that so attracted the Wilmots' attention could have been nothing more than a shooting star you make a wish on if you're lucky enough to see it before it disappears forever in a puff of flame. Soon it would be the July 4th weekend. And the Wilmots, Steve Robinson, and thousands of other local residents were looking forward to the unofficial start of the summer holiday. But at the 509th, there was no celebrating. The isolated incidents of unidentified radar blips at Roswell and White Sands continued to increase over the next couple of days until it looked like a steady stream of airspace violations. Now, it was becoming more than serious. There was no denying that a traffic pattern of strange aircraft overflights was emerging in the skies over the New Mexico desert where, with impunity, these unidentifiable radar blips hovered above and then darted away from our most secret military installations. By the time the military's own aircraft scrambled, the intruders were gone. It was obvious to the base commanders that they were under a heavy surveillance from a presence they could only assume was hostile. At first, nobody gave much thought to the possibility of extraterrestrials or flying saucers, even though they'd been in the news for the past few weeks that spring. Army officers at the 509th and White Sands thought it was the Russians spying on the military's first nuclear bomber base and its guided missile launching site. By now, Army counterintelligence, this highly secret command sector which in 1947 operated almost as much in the civilian sector as it did in the military, had spun up to its highest alert and ordered a full deployment of its most experienced crack World War II operatives out to Roswell. CIC personnel had begun to arrive from Washington when the first reports of strange radar blips were filed through intelligence channels and kept coming as reports continued to pile up with increasing urgency over the next 48 hours. Officers and enlisted men alike disembarked from the transport planes and changed into civilian clothes for the investigation into enemy activity on the area. They joined up with base intelligence officers like Major Jesse Marcel and Steve Arnold, a counterintelligence non-com who'd served at the Roswell base during World War II when the first nuclear bombing mission against Hiroshima was launched from there in August 1945, just about 2 years earlier. On the evening of July 4, 1947, though the dates may differ depending on who was telling the story, while the rest of the country was celebrating Independence Day and looking with great optimism at the costly peace that the sacrifice of its soldiers had brought, radar operators at sites around Roswell noticed that the strange objects were turning up again and looked almost as if they were changing their shapes on the screen. They were pulsating. It was the only way you could describe it, glowing more intensely and then dimly as tremendous thunderstorms broke out over the desert. Steve Arnold, posted to the Roswell Airfield Control Tower that evening, had never seen a blip behave like that as it darted across the screen between sweeps at speeds over 1,000 miles an hour. All the while it was pulsating, throbbing almost, until, while the skies over the base exploded in a biblical display of thunder and lightning, it arced to the lower left-hand quadrant of the screen, seemed to disappear for a moment, then exploded in a brilliant white fluorescence and evaporated right before his very eyes. The screen was clear. The blips were gone, and his controllers looked around at each other and at the CIC officers in the room. The same thought arose in all their minds. An object, whatever it was, had crashed. The military response was put into motion within seconds. This was a national security issue. Jump on that thing in the desert and bring it back before anybody else could find it. Even before the radar officer called the 509th Base Commander, Colonel William Blanchard, reporting that radar indicated the crash of an unidentified aircraft to the north and west of Roswell, the CIC dispatch team had already mobilized to deploy an immediate response crash and retrieval team to locate and secure the crash site. They believed this was an enemy aircraft that had slipped through a radar defense system either from South America or over the Canadian border and had taken photos of top-secret military installations. They also wanted to keep civilians away just in case, they said, there was any radiation from the craft's propulsion system, which allowed it to make hairpin turns at 3,000 miles an hour. Nobody knew how this thing was powered, and nobody knew whether any personnel had ejected from the craft and were wandering around the desert. Bull Blanchard green-lighted the retrieval mission to get out there as soon as possible, taking with them all the night patrol equipment they could scare up, all the 2.5-ton trucks they could roll, and the base's low-boy flatbed wreckers to bring the aircraft back. If it was a crash, they wanted to get it under wraps in a hangar before any civilian authorities could get their hands on it and blab to the newspaper. But the air controllers at the 509th weren't the only ones who thought they saw an aircraft go down. On the outskirts of the city, ranchers, families camping in the desert, and residents saw an aircraft that exploded in a bright light between flashes of lightning and plummeted to earth in the direction of Corona, the neighboring town to the north of Roswell. Chavez County Sheriff George Wilcox started receiving calls in his office shortly after midnight on the morning of the 5th that an airplane had crashed out in the desert, and he notified the Roswell Fire Department that he would dispatch them as soon as he had an approximate location. No sense pulling fire apparatus out of the station to chase something through the desert unless they knew where it was. Besides, Wilcox didn't like rolling the trucks out of town just in case there was a fire in the city that needed all the apparatus they could throw at it, especially the pumpers. However, finding the crash site didn't take long. A group of Indian artifact hunters camping in the scrub brush north of Roswell had also seen the pulsating light overhead, heard a burning hiss, and the strange ground-shaking thunk of a crash nearby in the distance, and followed the sound to a group of low hills just over a rise. Before they even inspected the smoking wreckage, they radioed the crash site location into Sheriff Wilcox's office, which dispatched the fire department to a spot about 37 miles north and west of the city. "I'm already on my way," he told the radio operator at the firehouse, who also called the city police for an escort. And by about 4:30 that morning, a single pumper and a police car were bouncing through the desert, taking Pine Lodge Road west to where Sheriff Wilcox had directed them. Neither the sheriff nor the fire department knew that a military retrieval team was also on its way to the site with orders to secure the location and, by any means necessary, prevent the unauthorized dissemination of any information about the crash. It was still dark when, from another direction, Steve Arnold, riding shotgun in one of the staff cars in the convoy of the recovery vehicles from the 509th, reached the crash site first. Even before their trucks rolled into position, an MP lieutenant from the 1st Jeep posted a picket of sentries, and an engineer ordered his unit to string a series of floodlights around the area. Then Arnold's car pulled up, and he got his own first glimpse of the wreckage. But it wasn't really wreckage at all. Not in the way he'd seen plane crashes during the war. From what he could make out through the purple darkness, the dark-skinned craft seemed mostly intact and had lost no large pieces. Sure, there were bits and pieces of debris all over the area, but the aircraft itself hadn't broken apart on impact the way a normal aeroplane would. And the whole scene was still shrouded in darkness. Then the staff cars and jeeps that had accompanied the trucks lined up head on to the crash and threw their headlights against the Arroyo to supplement the floodlights that were still being strung by the engineers. In the sudden intersecting beams of headlights, Arnold could see that, indeed, the soft-cornered, delta-shaped eggshell type of craft was essentially in one piece, even though it had embedded its nose hard into the embankment of the Arroyo with its tail high in the air. Heat was still rising off the debris, even though, according to the base radar at the 509th, the crash probably took place before midnight on the 4th. Then Arnold heard the brief sizzle of a battery charging up and the hum of a gasoline generator. That's when the string of lights came up, and the whole site suddenly looked like a baseball field before a big night game. In the stark light of the military searchlights, Arnold saw the entire landscape of the crash. He thought it looked more like a crash landing, because the craft was intact except for a split seam running lengthwise along the side, and the steep 45-plus degree angle of the craft's incline. He assumed it was a craft, even though it was like no airplane he'd ever seen. It was small, but it looked more like the flying wing shape of an old Curtiss than an ellipse or a saucer. And it had two tail fins on the top sides of the Delta's feet that pointed up and out. He angled himself as close to the split seam of the craft as he could get without stepping in front of the workers in hazardous material suits who were checking the site for radiation. And that was when he saw them in the shadow. Little, dark, gray figures, maybe 4, 4.5 feet in length, sprawled out across the ground. "Are those people?" Arnold heard someone say as medics rushed up with stretchers to the knife-like lacerations along the side of the craft through which the bodies had either crawled out or tumbled. Arnold looked around the perimeter of light and saw another figure, motionless but menacing nevertheless, and another leaning against a small rise in the desert sand. There was a fifth figure near the opening of the craft. As radiation technicians gave the all clear and medics ran to the bodies with stretchers, Arnold sneaked a look through the rip in the aircraft and stared out through the top. Jehoshaphat! It looked like the sun was already up. Just to make sure, Steve Arnold looked around the outside again, and sure enough, it was still too dark to call it daylight. But through the top of the craft, as if he were looking through a lens, Arnold could see an eerie stream of light. Not daylight or lamplight, but light nevertheless. He'd never seen anything like that before and thought that maybe this was a weapon the Russians or somebody else had developed. The scene of the crash was a microcosm of chaos. Technicians with specific tasks, such as medics, hazardous material sweepers, signalmen, and radio operators and sentries were carrying out their jobs as methodically and unthinkingly as if they were the Emperor Ming's brainwashed, furnace-stoking zombies from the Flash Gordon serials. But everyone else, including the officers, were simply awestruck. They'd never seen anything like this before, and they stood there overpowered, it seemed, by simply a general sense of amazement that would not let them out of its grip. "Hey, this one's alive," Arnold heard, and turned around to see one of the figures struggling on the ground. With the rest of the medics, he ran over to it and watched as it shuddered and made a crying sound that echoed not in the air, but in his brain. He heard nothing through his ears, but felt an overwhelming sense of sadness as the little figure convulsed on the ground, its oversized, egg-shaped skull flipping from side to side as if it were trying to gasp for something to breathe. That's when he heard the sentry shout, "Hey, you!" and turned back to the shallow rise opposite the arroyo. "Halt!" the sentry screamed at the small figure that had gotten up and was trying desperately to climb over the hill. "Halt!" the sentry yelled again and brought his M1 to bear. Other soldiers ran toward the hill as the figure slipped in the sand, started to slide down, caught his footing, and climbed again. The sound of soldiers locking and loading rounds in their chambers carried loud across the desert through the pre-dawn darkness. "No!" one of the officers shouted. Arnold couldn't see which one, but it was too late. There was a rolling volley of shots from the nervous soldiers, and the small figure tried to stand as he was flung over like a rag doll and then down the hill by the rounds that tore into him. He lay motionless in the sand as the first three soldiers to reach him stood over the body, chambered new rounds, and pointed their weapons at his chest. "Fuck!" the officer spit again. "Arnold!" Steve Arnold snapped to attention. "You and your men get out there and stop those civilians from crossing this perimeter." He motioned to a small convoy of emergency vehicles approaching from the east. He knew they had to be police or county sheriff. Then he called out, "Medics!" Arnold jumped to at once, and by the time the medics were loading the little creature on a stretcher, he was already setting up a perimeter of CIC personnel and sentries to block the sight from the flashing lights and churning sand far in the distance to the south of them. He heard the officer order the medics to load the bodies on stretchers, pack them in the back of whatever 2.5-ton GMC he could pull off the line, and drive them back to the base immediately. "Sergeant," the officer called out again, "I want your men to load up everything that can be loaded on these 2.5s and sway that damn, whatever it is," he was pointing to the delta-shaped object, "on this low boy and get it out of here. The rest of you," he called out, "I want this place spotless. Nothing ever happened here, you understand? Just a nothing piece of scrub brush like the rest of this desert." As the soldiers formed an arm-in-arm search and rescue grid, some on their hands and knees to clean the area of any pieces of debris, devices, or chunks of wreckage, the huge retrieval crane that had been deployed from the airbase hoisted the surprisingly light flying object out of its impact crater in the arroyo and swayed it above the long flatbed Ford that accompanied the convoy of army trucks. A small squad of MPs were deployed to face the civilian convoy of emergency vehicles quickly approaching the site. They fixed bayonets and lowered their M1 barrels at the whirlwind of sand directly in front of them. On the other side of the skirmish line, Roswell firefighter Dan Dwyer, the radio man riding shotgun on the red Ward LaFrance pumper the company rolled out that night along with the tanker, could see very little at first except for an oasis of white light in the center of darkness. His small convoy had been running lights but no sirens as they pulled out of the firehouse in the center of Roswell, rendezvoused with the police car north of town, and headed out to the site to rescue what he had been told was a downed aircraft. As he approached the brightly lit area of floodlights off in the distance, it looked more like a traveling amusement park than a crash site. He could already see the soldiers in a rough circle around an object that was swinging from the arm of a crane. As the LaFrance got closer, Dwyer could just make out the strange deltoid shape of the thing as it hung, very precariously, from the arm, almost dropping once or twice under the very inexperienced control of the equipment operator. Even at this distance, the sound of shouting and cursing was carrying across the sand as the crane was raised, then lowered, then raised, as the object finally sat over the Ford flatbed trailer. The police unit ahead of the fire truck suddenly shot out toward the brightly lit area as soon as the driver saw the activity, and immediately the area was obscured from Dwyer's vision by clouds of sand that diffused the light. All he could see through the thicket of sand were the reflections of his own flashing lights. When the sand cleared, they were almost on top of the site, swinging off to one side to avoid the army trucks that had already started back down the road toward them. Dwyer looked over his shoulder to see if any more military vehicles were headed his way, but all he saw were the first pink lines of sunlight over the horizon. It was almost morning. By the time Dwyer's field truck pulled around to the area the soldiers had pointed out, whatever it was that had crashed was sitting on the flatbed, still clamped to the hovering crane. Three or four soldiers were working on the coupling and securing the object to the truck with chains and cable. But for something that had dropped out of the sky in a fireball, which was how the police described it, Dwyer noted that the object looked almost unscathed. He couldn't see any cracks in the object's skin, and there were no pieces that had broken off. Then the soldiers dropped an olive tarp over the flatbed, and the object was completely camouflaged. An army captain walked over to one of the police units parked directly in front of the fire truck, and behind the officer stood a line of bayonet-wielding soldiers sporting MP armbands. "You guys head on back," Dwyer heard the captain tell one of the Roswell police officers on the scene. "We got the area secured." "What about injuries?" the police officer asked, maybe thinking more about the incident report he had to fill out than about what to do with any casualties. "No injuries. We have everything under control," the captain said. But even as the military was waving off the civilian convoy, Dwyer could see small bodies being lifted on stretchers from the ground into army transport trucks. A couple of them were already in body bags, but one, not bagged, was strapped directly onto the stretcher. The police officer saw it too. This one, Dwyer could tell, was moving around and seemed to be alive. He had to get closer. "What about them?" he asked. "Hey! Get those things loaded," the captain shouted at the enlisted men loading the stretchers onto the truck. "You didn't see anything here tonight, officer," he told the driver of the police unit. "Nothing at all." "But I gotta..." the captain cut him off. "Later today, I'm sure there'll be someone from the base out to talk to the shift. Meanwhile, let this one alone. Strictly military business." By this time, Dwyer thought he recognized people he knew from the Army airfield. He thought he could see the base intelligence officer, Jesse Marcel, who lived off the base in Roswell, and other personnel who came into town on a regular basis. He saw debris from whatever had crashed still lying all over the ground as the flatbed truck pulled out, past the fire apparatus, and rumbled off through the sand back on the road toward the base. Dwyer took off his helmet, climbed down from the truck, and worked his way through the shadows around the flank of the line of MPs. There was so much confusion at the sight, Dwyer knew no one would notice if he looked around. He walked around in back of the truck, across the perimeter, and from the other side of the military transport, walked up to the stretcher. He looked directly down into the eyes of the creature strapped onto the stretcher and just stared. It was no bigger than a child, he thought, but it wasn't a child. No child had such an oversized balloon-shaped head. It didn't even look human, although it had human-like features. Its eyes were large and dark, set apart from each other on a downward slope. Its nose and mouth were especially tiny, almost like slits, and its ears were not much more than indentations along the side of its huge head. In the glare of the floodlight, Dwyer could see the creature was a grayish-brown and completely hairless, but it looked directly at him as if it were a helpless animal in a trap. It didn't make a sound, but somehow Dwyer understood that the creature understood it was dying. He could gape in astonishment at the thing, but it was quickly loaded onto a truck by a couple of soldiers in helmets who asked him what he was doing. Dwyer knew this was bigger than anything he'd ever wanted to see and got out of there right away, losing himself amidst a group of personnel working around a pile of debris. The whole site was scattered with articles that Dwyer assumed had fallen out of the craft when it hit. He could see the indentation in the Arroyo where it looked like the object embedded itself and followed with his eyes the pattern of debris stretching out from the small crater into the darkness beyond the floodlights. The soldiers were crawling all over on their hands and knees with scraping devices and carrying sacks or walking in straight lines waving metal detectors in front of them. They were sweeping the area clean, it seemed to him, so that any curiosity seekers who floated out here during the day would find nothing to reveal the identity of what had been here. Dwyer reached down to pick up a patch of dull, gray, metallic, cloth-like material that seemed to shine up at him from the sand. He stuffed it into his fist and rolled it into a ball. Then he released it, and the metallic fabric snapped back into shape without any creases or folds. He thought, no one was looking at him, so he stuffed it into the pocket of his fire jacket to bring back to the firehouse. He would later show it to his young daughter, who, 45 years later and long after the piece of metallic fabric itself had disappeared into history, would describe it on television documentaries to millions of people. But that night in July 1947, if Dwyer thought he was invisible, he was wrong. "Hey, you!" a sergeant wearing an MP armband bawled. "What the hell are you doing out here?" "I responded with the fire company," Dwyer said as innocently as possible. "Will you get your civilian ass back on that truck and get the hell out of here?" he ordered. "You take anything with you?" "Not me, sergeant," Dwyer said. The MP grabbed him as if he were under arrest and hustled him off to a major who was shouting orders near the generator that was powering the string of floodlights. He recognized him as Roswell resident Jesse Marcel. "Caught this fireman wandering around on the debris, sir," the sergeant reported. Marcel obviously recognized Dwyer, although the two men weren't friends, and gave him what the fireman only remembered was an agonized look. "You got to get out of here," he said, "and never tell anyone where you were or what you saw." Dwyer nodded. "I mean it. This is top security here. The kind of thing that could get you put away," Marcel continued. "Whatever this is, don't talk about it. Don't say anything until somebody tells you what to say. Now get your truck out of here before someone else sees you and tries to lock up the whole bunch of you. Move." He faced the helmeted MP. "Sergeant, get him back on that truck and move it out." Dwyer didn't need any more invitations. He let the sergeant hustle him along, put him back on the truck, and told his driver to bring it back to the station. The MP sergeant came up to the driver's side window, looked at the fireman behind the wheel. "You've been ordered to evacuate the site," the MP told the driver, "at
at once.
The Roswell police unit had already made a U-turn on the sand and was motioning for the truck to back up. The driver dropped the truck into reverse, gently fed it gas as its wheels dug into the sand, made his U-turn, and headed back for the firehouse in Roswell. The Ford flatbed had already passed through the sleeping town in the moments between the darkness and light, the sound of its engines causing no alarm or stir. The sight of a large tarpaulin-covered object on the back of an army vehicle rolling along the main street of Roswell against the purple-gray sky raising nobody's eyebrows because it was nothing out of the ordinary. But later, by the time Dwyer backed his field truck into the station house, the sun was already up and the first of the GMC transport trucks was just reaching the main gate at the 509th. Plumbing subcontractor Roy Danzer, who had worked through the night at the base fitting pipe, knew something was up from the way the trucks tore out of the compound through the darkness. He had just walked out of the base hospital to grab a cigarette before going back to work. That's when he heard the commotion over at the main gate. Danzer had cut his hand a few days earlier cutting pipe, and the infirmary nurse wanted to keep checking the stitches to make sure no infection was setting in. So Danzer took the opportunity to get away from the job for a few minutes while the nurse looked over her work and changed his bandage. Then, on his way back to the job, he would grab a cup of coffee, take an unscheduled cigarette break. But this morning, things would be very different. The commotion he heard by the main gate had now turned into a swirling throng of soldiers, and base workers shoved aside by what looked like a squad of MPs using their bodies as a wedge to force a pathway through the crowd. There didn't even seem to be an officer giving orders, just a crowd of soldiers. Strange. Then the throng headed right for the base hospital, right for the main entrance, right for the very spot where Roy was standing. Nobody moved him out of the way or told him to vacate the area. In fact, no one even spoke to him. Roy just looked down as the line of soldiers passed him, and there it was, strapped tightly to a stretcher that two bearers were carrying into the base hospital right through the main door. Roy looked at it. It looked at Roy, and as their eyes met, Roy knew in an instant that he was not looking down at a human being. It was a creature from somewhere else, the pleading look on its face occupying only a small frontal portion of its huge watermelon-sized skull, and the emotion of pain and suffering that played itself behind Roy Danzer's eyes and across his brain while he stared down at the figure told Roy it was in its final moments of life. It didn't speak. It could barely move. But Roy actually saw, or believed he saw, an expression cross over its little circle of a face. And then the creature was gone, carried into the hospital by the stretcher bearers, who shot him an ugly glare as they passed. Roy took another drag on the cigarette butt still in his hand. "What the hell was that?" he said to no one in particular. Then he felt like he'd been hit by the front four of the Notre Dame football team. His head snapped back against the top of his spine as he went flying forward into the arms of a couple of MPs who slammed him against an iron gate and kept him there until an officer, he thought it was a captain, walked up and stuck his finger directly into Danzer's face. "Just who are you, mister?" the captain bellowed into Danzer's ear. Even before Danzer could answer, two other officers walked up and began demanding what authorization Danzer had to be on the base. These guys weren't kidding, Danzer thought to himself. They looked ugly and were working themselves up into a serious lather. For a few tense minutes, Roy Danzer thought he would never see his family again. He was that scared. But then a major approached and broke into the shouting. "I know this guy," the major said. "He works here with the other civilian contractors. He's okay." "Sir," the captain sputtered. But the major, Danzer didn't know his name, took the captain by the arm right out of earshot. Danzer could see them talking and watched as the red-faced captain gradually calmed down. Then the two returned to where the MPs were holding Danzer against the wall. "You saw nothing, you understand?" the captain said to Danzer, who just nodded. You're not to tell anybody about this. Not your family, not your friends, nobody. You got that?
Yes, sir, Danzer said. He was truly afraid now.
We'll know if you talk. We'll know.